call this meeting, remote meeting of the House Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. It is Thursday, March 3rd, 2022. And we're hearing this, we are holding this hearing remotely under Rule 10.01. It does look like there is a quorum present. Anna, please take the roll.
Chair Beckerman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Here.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Herr.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Mortensen.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Novotny present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
And Representative Zhang.
Present.
Madam Chair, we have a quorum present.
And Madam Chair, I'd like to change my aye to present. Haven't had enough coffee. And it looks like her computer froze, actually. All right. So members, I guess that is my cue to take the virtual gavel until we can get back on here. We need to approve the minutes from March 1st, 2022. Representative Scott, would you move approval of the minutes?
I certainly will, Madam Chair. I still move.
All right, Representative Scott moves approval of the minutes from March 1st, 2022. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes from March 1st, 2022 are approved. The first bill on the agenda today is House File 2665, Representative Hollins' bill regarding emancipated minors seeking harassment restraining orders. Representative Hollins, would you like to move that House File 2665 be referred to the General Register?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, so moved.
All right. And Representative Hollins, I believe you have a DE2 amendment.
That is correct.
All right. Would you like to move the DE2 amendment?
I would. Thank you.
All right, members, all those in favor of the DE2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the DE2 amendment is adopted. And so Representative Hollins moves House File 2665 as amended be referred to the General Register. Representative Hollins, please go ahead and describe your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. Before I describe this bill, I just want to thank Representative Novotny. The DE2 amendment was a product of his interest and involvement in this issue and his years of experience, and I was really appreciative for his help and support. This bill is about protecting vulnerable youth. It establishes a statutory process for an emancipated minor to petition the court for a harassment restraining order. For those of you who don't know or don't work in this area very often, there's already a process in the statute for a minor to obtain an order for protection, but there's a gap in Minnesota law that doesn't offer the same safety net when there is a harassment restraining order needed. And in case you're not familiar, an OFP or order for protection is called when there is an established familial or romantic relationship between two people. And an HRO is needed when there's not a relationship between those two individuals. So this bill is narrowly tailored to cover emancipated youth. These are kids who are living on their own because their parents have relinquished their parental responsibility and left these children to fend for themselves. Unfortunately, these youth are very vulnerable to sexual predation and other forms of exploitation, stalking, and other dangers for which an HRO is needed. But under current law, a youth in these situations has no way to seek an HRO. So this bill fixes that. What the amended bill does is create the right for a minor who can demonstrate that they are emancipated to ask the court to issue an HRO. It establishes criteria to determine emancipation, essentially codifying a longstanding common law standard and enumerating the various ways a petitioner can prove that they are emancipated. And it allows the court to issue the order if it finds that it is in the best interest of the minor petitioner to do so. There is currently no opposition to this bill. And I believe that we have one testifier, Ron Elwood from Legal Aid.
All right, thank you, Representative Hollins. Looks like Chair Becker-Finn is back. So I will hand over the virtual gavel to Chair Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Vice Chair Mueller. Hopefully Steve Jobs' ghost is done screwing with my computer this morning. We'll go to the first testifier, Ron Elwood, if you could introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome back. And my name is Ron Elwood. I'm with Legal Aid. And I also want to thank Representative Hollins for carrying the bill and Representative Novotny for working so closely to iron out some of the kinks in the original draft and get it to where it is today, where I think it is ready for prime time. I won't spend much time here, but I just want to tell you that Legal Aid's Youth Law Project handles cases of this nature, and that is why we've asked Representative Hollins and Representative Novotny to help move this bill forward. I can tell you that from our experience, every year we have kids in this situation, and it's a tool in that legal toolbox that is just missing. And they really need, these kids who come to us for help really need this kind of protection. The gap in the law needs to be filled, and that's what this bill does. And we really appreciate all your help and support, and we urge you to vote for it. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you for your testimony. I do not have any other testifiers on the list, so we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question might go to either the author or to Mr. Elwood. And just for the record, I think I've heard the stats of about how many kids this might affect. It's not a large number, but to those kids, this is a significant change. So if you could address that would be great.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Scott. I think you stated it very eloquently. You're right. This is not a huge number of youths that will be affected by this, but for those who are affected, they have literally no other way of accessing this sort of protection. And so it does have a huge impact on them. It doesn't make a substantial change that opens it up where, you know, it will be taken advantage of in any particular way. And so I think it really is good law. And I'll ask Mr. Elwood to speak to that if he has any additional statistics on how many youth are affected by it.
Mr. Elwood.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, and Representative Scott. I don't know of any other organization that actually represents kids in this situation, so I can speak only really for Legal Aid. And it would be probably in the single digits per year that we hand. Those are the kinds of cases, numbers of cases. So, but I just want to echo what Representative Hollins said. Oftentimes when you legislate, you legislate in sort of two different reasons. One, because there's a giant problem that affects a lot of people, or in this case, a small number of people are affected, but in a major way. And that's why we're here. So thank you very much.
Any follow-up, Representative Scott?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you to the author and Representative Botany for working on this, and I think it's needed and I support it. Thank you.
All right, members, any further discussion to the bill? All right, seeing none, closing comments, Representative Hollins.
I'll be super brief. I just want to thank Mr. Ron Elwood for working with me on this, continue to thank Representative Novotny, and I hope that you can all vote yes on this bill. Thank you.
All right. With that, you guys will have to remind me. I don't know who made the motion. Did Representative Hollins make the motion?
Representative Hollins made the motion, Madam Chair, and it's the bill as amended.
Thank you, Vice Chair Mueller. Representative Hollins renews her motion that House File 2665 as amended be referred to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Vice Chair Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott?
Aye.
Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Frazier?
Aye.
Representative Grossel?
Aye.
Representative Herr?
Aye.
Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Mortensen?
Aye.
Representative Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Representative Farr?
Aye.
Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
And Representative Zhang?
Aye.
That is 17 ayes and no nays.
The motion prevails and House File 2665 as amended is referred to the General Register. Moving on to the next bill, another Representative Hollins bill, House File 3270. Representative Hollins, would you like to move your bill be referred to the General Register?
Yes, Madam Chair, so moved.
All right, the bill is now before us. It doesn't look like we have any amendments on this one, so please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you again, committee members. I am really excited to be carrying House File 3270, which is also called the Take Pride Act. In summary, the Take Pride Act removes the employment exemption that gives youth-focused non-public organizations the ability to not hire someone based on someone's sexual orientation or gender identity. It removes a housing exemption that gives individuals who own duplex units the ability to not rent a spare duplex unit to someone based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. And it fully repeals a section of the Minnesota Human Rights Act that states Minnesota does not condone homosexuality, bisexuality, or any other equivalent lifestyle. This section also has unenforceable language around same-sex marriage. As we know, things have changed since that bill was put into place. So essentially, it removes three unnecessary, outdated, anti-LGBTQ provisions from the Minnesota Human Rights Act. As you can see, it's pretty straightforward. It simply repeals the language from our civil rights law. And this is particularly important to me and also important to other members of the LGBTQ community because these archaic pieces of law are really harmful to see in our statute day in and day out. It does change things technically substantially, but the reality is most of these exceptions aren't being used currently. And so it also neatens up the statute so that it is easier to read and easier to process for most people who might be, you know, trying to figure out how exactly to follow the rules that they need to. So I'm very proud to be carrying this, and I am looking forward to a good discussion on it. I do have a couple of testifiers. I have Commissioner Lucero from the Department of Human Rights, and I believe we have a testifier from the Girl Scouts as well.
All right, we'll go on to testimony. Commissioner Lucero, if you can introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Yeah, absolutely. Good morning, everyone. My name is Rebecca Lucero, and I'm the Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. First, thank you, Representative Hollins, for carrying this agency bill, and to the committee for giving the bill a hearing this morning. So House File 3270, otherwise known as the Take Pride Act, is a bill that's long overdue. So let's take a step back and talk about how Minnesota was the first state in the country to prohibit sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination at work and in housing. So back in 1993, state legislators came together across party lines to ensure that LGBTQ Minnesotans were not discriminated against on the basis of basics for life. I mean, particularly in housing and employment. A lot has changed in the past 30 years. The Minnesota legislature passed marriage between same-sex couples in 2013. The US Supreme Court ruled in 2015 in Obergefell saying that there is a right for marriage between same-sex couples under the Constitution. And in 2020, the US Supreme Court Bostock decision held that an employer who fires an individual because they are LGBTQ is a violation of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, matching what has already been the law in Minnesota since 1993. So a lot has changed. And that's why the agency is moving this bill to update these three narrow sections of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. While the bill proposes striking these three areas, there are some things that do not change. And I want to take a moment to highlight those, as I think there may be some misunderstandings about this bill, and I just want to address those right now. So first, the bill removes no restrictions of the use of one's own home. You can find those right now under Minnesota Statute 363.21, Subdivision 1, Paragraph 2. Those remain fully in place. When it comes to your home, this bill does not change the fact that you get to select who lives in your home. There are no limitations on who you choose to live with in your own home. Your home is where you live. You know, when I was younger and I did not have this very active dog that requires a yard, I lived in an apartment building, several apartment buildings, roommates. I very much got to decide who my roommates were. That's true today in my own home. The law doesn't say who gets to live in my home. I do, but I don't get to decide who gets to live in the apartment downstairs. Nothing about that changes here. People can make decisions about who they live with in their own homes for any reason or no reason at all. There also seems to be some confusion about what this bill does regarding nonprofit organizations. So I want to clarify that too. Now there are nonprofits, then there are nonprofits that are religious in nature. For nonprofits that are religious in nature, they can continue to place restrictions based on religion or sexual orientation. For nonprofit organizations that are not religious in nature, by far and away, the vast majority are already required to follow non-discriminatory laws, just like for-profit corporations. So this is a very narrow update, and the religious organization exemption stays in place. And that religious organization exemption, you can see that laid out in Minnesota Statute 363.20 Subdivision 2, excuse me. So importantly, the Minnesota Human Rights Act doesn't tell people what they can believe. No law can. That is fully protected for every American under the Constitution. And in fact, the Minnesota Human Rights Act protects Minnesotans against religious discrimination. And we take religious discrimination cases regularly. So let me go ahead and highlight all the support that exists for this bill. In addition to Girl Scouts of Minnesota and Wisconsin River Valley, who will be testifying today, I want to make sure members see the letters of support from 4-H and the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. And I also want to thank the Boys and Girls Clubs of the Twin Cities, Rochester, Bemidji, Central Minnesota, and Northland for their support for this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions after the testimony is complete.
Thank you. Right, thank you, Commissioner. We'll move to the next testifier. I have Jen Thorson. If you can introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jen Thorson. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Girl Scouts of Minnesota and Wisconsin River Valleys. Thank you to Representative Hollins for carrying this bill and to the committee for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3270, and specifically the portion of the bill that removes the exemption allowing youth-focused organizations like ours to make hiring decisions based on sexual orientation. Girl Scouts of Minnesota, Wisconsin River Valleys is one of the largest Girl Scout councils among the 111 in the United States. In partnership with more than 9,000 volunteers, we serve more than 20,000 girls in 49 counties in southern Minnesota, western Wisconsin, and one county in Iowa. Girl Scouts provides opportunities for girls and non-binary youth to develop skills, confidence, and character that sets them up for successful futures. In our council, our purpose is to boldly lead as an anti-racist organization that uplifts and empowers every girl to know their worth and lead in their world. We value diversity in all its forms and are firmly committed to providing a welcoming and inclusive environment for every Girl Scout, family, volunteer, and staff member. Therefore, the current law's employment exemption for youth-focused organizations is contrary to our mission, purpose, values, and practice. Removing the exemption will not change our business operations. We are already committed to hiring an inclusive and diverse workforce, and we believe that Girl Scouts, staff members, and volunteers need to see themselves represented and affirmed. Given these reasons, we support the provision in this bill removing this exemption from our state civil rights laws. We believe that it's critical that we as a state demonstrate our commitment to advancing equity and inclusion for all Minnesotans under the law. Representation matters, inclusion matters, belonging matters, and words matter. Girl Scouts never did and never would utilize the exemption granted to us in the current law. Girl Scouts did not ask for this exemption and would not have supported it when originally proposed and passed. A core part of our mission and purpose is empowering Girl Scouts to speak up and out for their values, and I'm grateful to be able to do that today on behalf of Girl Scouts and all Minnesotans. Thank you again for your service on this committee and your attention to this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. I'm kind of bummed we're not in person. I feel like it would have been a prime opportunity for Representative Hollins to bring us some cookies. So you owe me, Representative Hollins. Those are the only testifiers I have on the list. So we will move on to member discussion. If members have any questions, I know the testifiers can stick around as well. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question. I don't know if this is for the bill's author or for the commissioner, but I was reading over the letter sent to us by the Minnesota Catholic Conference, and it was interesting for me to learn that what the intent of this language was used for back in 1993 when it was established. And they state that the language was able to pass because there were sufficient accommodations for people and organizations, particularly religious organizations, who in good conscience held traditional views about sex and sexual identity. And it acted as a shield for certain individuals and organizations to be protected from the HRA being weaponized by those identified as LGBT or other associated activist groups. So my concern is that is we have this balance right now, that it protects both religious or mission, specifically mission-minded organizations, and this language being removed would take away that balance. And I found it interesting that back in 1993, that the Catholic Conference didn't oppose the protected class of sexual orientation. And so it seems like it was very thoughtfully put into place in 1993. And I feel like this is going to upset the fruit basket. And so I just, and upset that balance. So I don't know which one of you want to take that question, but that's my question.
Representative Hollins.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Scott. I think that's a great question. I'm going to pass it to Commissioner Lucero to take that question.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin, Representative Scott. Thank you for the question. So I want to make sure to be very clear, because it does seem like there's some confusion about this, what this bill does. The religious organization exemption that is being discussed there in that letter stays in place. That's there. That's Minnesota Statute 363.20 Subdivision 2. So that stays in place, 363A, excuse me. That means that this is a narrow bill about nonprofits. There are nonprofits, and there are nonprofits that are religious in nature. For nonprofits that are religious in nature, they can continue to place restrictions based on religion or sexual orientation under that exemption under 363A.20 Subdivision 2, which again remains in place. This is a narrow piece that is specifically looking at nonprofit organizations that are not religious in nature. The vast majority of these nonprofit organizations that are not religious in nature are already required to follow non-discriminatory laws, just like for-profit corporations. So it does not impact religious organizations in any way.
Follow-up, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, thank you for answering the question. I'm not sure. There are some nonprofits that may not be religious in their mission, but they may have specific missions that this may come in conflict with. So those folks are just, this new law would apply to them. They wouldn't have a choice then. Is that correct? There would be no protection for them.
Commissioner Lucero.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Representative Scott. So the vast majority of nonprofits are already required to follow non-discriminatory laws, just like all for-profit corporations are. This is very, very narrow. This is impacting specifically just what the narrow exemption is there for. And religious organization exemptions completely stay in place. A nonprofit such as the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, for instance, is not right now allowed to discriminate based on race, sexual orientation, religion. So the exemption that you're concerned with, it stays in place.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My other question is, you know, there's a Supreme Court case, I believe it's back in 1990, I think, Boy Scouts of America versus Dale. And just wondered if you're familiar with that case. And what they found in that case was that there was an issue with freedom of association. And they found in favor, the Supreme Court of the United States found in favor of the Boy Scouts. So I'm just wondering if you could comment on how that court decision might interact with what this bill is attempting to do.
Commissioner Lucero, hopefully you're familiar with that Supreme Court case.
Yes, thank you, Chair Beckerman, Representative Scott. Yeah, Boy Scouts of America at this point is, like you mentioned, quite an old case. And a lot has changed since back then, including with the Boy Scouts themselves. Again, this is a narrow exemption about nonprofits, but religious nonprofits are able to maintain the exemption that's in place, and they are able to make decisions based on religion and sexual orientation. That is in the statute that stays in place.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you didn't answer my question. My question was the freedom of association that the Supreme Court found. How does that interact with what you're trying to do here?
Commissioner Lucero.
Representative Scott, all nonprofits and for-profits have to follow non-discriminatory laws. And I apologize, I'm not going to be able to answer the specific questions about Dale v. Boy Scouts of America, because it's been quite some time since I've studied that case. However, what's important is that non-discriminatory laws exist today in Minnesota. They have existed for 30 years. And that is what happens when you are doing business. But I appreciate the question and we'll follow up.
Any additional follow-up, Representative Scott? Otherwise, I want to get to other member questions.
I'm finished. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Navani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Commissioner Lucero, two questions. First one's pretty simple. What are we trying to fix if there's very narrow things and can you give us an example of what we're trying to fix? And the second question would be, so if there's, say, a group of, there's a nonprofit that provides counseling to female victims of sexual assault. And because of the trauma that these victims have suffered, they do not feel comfortable around a male. Would that be a group as a nonprofit with a non-religious exemption? Would they be forced to have a male counselor, no matter what the wishes or the conditions of the people that they're trying to work with would like?
Okay. I'm just going to say it would be really helpful if we're going to ask really complex questions like that. I'll go back to you and let you ask your second question, but I couldn't even hold both of those full questions in my head at the same time. Right. And I'm going to go to Representative Hollins first because it's her bill to respond.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Botany. You know, on the first question, I can say that it is important for our community members and our citizens who are LGBTQ to see themselves reflected in the Minnesota statute and to see that we are not being purposefully discriminated against because of our sexual orientation or gender identity. And I agree, this is narrow exceptions, and it might not mean a lot to you or a lot to people who are in nonprofits or who own a duplex. And it probably doesn't change most of the behaviors or policies of those organizations or individuals. But the reality is I get multiple people contacting me every session talking about these statutes and talking about how they feel like they are not being heard and they are not being represented by our Minnesota statutes. And as Minnesota citizens, they deserve to be as present and have as much access as any other Minnesota citizen does. So I do think this is important. I do think that it is meaningful. And I think that we will hear, you know, if this passes, I think we will hear a lot of people feeling good about it, even if it doesn't necessarily impact their day-to-day lives. For your second question, I will defer to Commissioner Lucero.
Commissioner Lucero.
Thank you. Chair Beckerfin, Representative Novotny. So there is something in the law. I actually really love that we're doing a deep dive into discrimination law. It's something that we could spend a lot of time on. So I apologize that we don't kind of have the time to go into all of it, but I'm happy to meet offline with it. There is something in the law called a bona fide occupational qualification. For those of you who maybe went to law school, you refer to it as a BFOQ. This recognizes that in some extremely rare instances, a person's sex, religion, or national origin may be reasonably necessary to carry out a particular job. And so it could be, for instance, in the counseling situation you're talking about, or maybe in the healthcare situation you're talking about, this is anti-discrimination law that has nothing to do with these provisions that we're just trying to update. The BFOQ, the bona fide occupational qualification, is something that exists today and remains in place under the law, and it's really well-established case law around it.
Thank you, Commissioner Lucero. Follow-up, Representative Novotny.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair, or thank you, Commissioner Lucero. Is that specifically addressed in this? I mean, I didn't see that language that gives the exemptions for the bona fide occupational exemptions.
First, I will say, and this is just a pet peeve of mine, but maybe it's helpful for folks. Often when we print out the bills, it doesn't really give you enough of the surrounding statutes to be super helpful. So if members are able, if you pull up statute C363A.20, a lot of what Commissioner Lucero is speaking to will make a lot more sense. But if you know offhand, Commissioner Lucero, which part of the statute that piece is in, that would be really helpful. So Commissioner Lucero.
Great. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Novotny. We are not changing that part of the statute. We're not proposing any changes to that part of the statute that have anything to do with sex. That is really well established court in law. It's not included in this bill because we aren't proposing a change in that part of law.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Commissioner, thank you, Chair.
All right, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hollins. I'm not sure if this is for Representative Hollins or Commissioner Lucero. So I do have some concerns about repealing the nonprofit service organization exemption because I have the statute up here on my other screen, and at the religious or fraternal organization that remains in place is very narrow. It says it does not apply to a religious or fraternal corporation, association, or society with respect to qualifications, et cetera. And so that's very narrow. And in my experience, there are nonprofits that wouldn't probably fit that religious definition, but that still are their foundation is a religious mission. So like faith-based community development organizations, faith-based sports ministries, faith-based groups that maybe are affiliated with a church but are incorporated separately from a church, but they're still mission-driven by their religious values. So I just wondered if you could speak to that specific instance, because it seems like those groups would be cut out of the exemption when you strike that subdivision 3 on nonprofit service organizations.
Representative Hollins, feel free to defer, but you're the chief author, so I always like to go back to the author of the bill.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hollins. Now I'm doing it. Representative Robbins. Oh no. Sorry. That happened to us on a previous
I remember
previous hearing. They kept calling me Representative Robbins. Apologies. I will defer to Commissioner Lucero on this. I do think that she has answered this question when Representative Scott was asking it, but if there is some additional nuance that she would like to add to it, I'm happy to defer.
Commissioner Lucero.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Robbins, thank you for that question. So the religious or fraternal organization exemption that's laid out in Subdivision 2 is actually applied pretty broadly because it's interpreted quite a bit by courts. So anyone that's really affiliated, you don't have to be affiliated with the church. Nonprofit organizations that are religious in nature are eligible for this exemption that's in place.
And
Representative Robbins,
that?
Representative Robbins,
I'm sorry.
You have to let her finish and then we're going to take turns. Commissioner Lucero.
I'm so sorry, Representative Robbins, but I just want to say that there are lots of nonprofits that are religious in nature or have like a religious grounding that are still not eligible for this exemption that we're proposing updating. So for instance, I haven't talked to any of these nonprofits, but there's lots of nonprofits that are mission-driven and based in religion, but because they aren't they don't meet this narrow definition, they are required to follow non-discriminatory laws as a nonprofit, just like any for-profit corporation. It's a very narrow update.
All right, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So sorry, I was just excited what she was sharing. So that helps, Commissioner Lucero, but it also seems like like you started down the path of saying that religious nonprofits that are religiously affiliated would not be impacted. But then just at your closing comments there, then you said, but this is very small and narrow and religiously affiliated groups are going to be covered under removing this exemption. So if religiously affiliated nonprofits are still going to be covered under the religious or fraternal subdivision 2, could we clarify that somehow by saying religiously affiliated nonprofits are covered under sub 2 or something to provide sort of that balance that we had in the 1993 version of this?
Commissioner Lucero.
Representative Robbins, yes, thank you. I see exactly what I did there that led to that. So thank you for pointing that out here. So there are nonprofits that are religious in nature. They can continue to place restrictions based on religion or sexual orientation. That remains in place. For nonprofit organizations that are not religious in nature, this is the vast majority, they are already required to follow non-discriminatory laws. And so this narrow update applies only to what's laid out in this exemption that we're proposing to strike here.
Follow-up, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. So I'm sort of back to not feeling like religiously affiliated, but not technically religious organizations would no longer be exempt. Is that accurate?
Commissioner Lucero.
So I think this is one of those situations where we're speaking, Chair and Representative Robbins. I think this is one of those situations that would require a little bit more facts to understand what's actually going on, because there's a lot of variation there that you can talk about. Everything from Habitat to Humanity to Girl Scouts of America to a religious organization that hosts a lot of youth events like sporting events. And so you'd have to look at it a little bit more carefully. However, across the board, nonprofits that are religious in nature have this exemption in place today, and that does not change. That stays even with this update.
All right. Any follow-up, Representative Robbins? Otherwise, I'm going to get to other members. All right. Representative Feist.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a general comment and then a question for Commissioner Lucero. In general, my understanding from Representative Holland's presentation is that we're trying to address aspects of our current state statutes that just feel out of date and out of step with our, you know, goal of having a welcoming, inclusive state of Minnesota, and that this likely isn't going to affect a dramatically huge number of organizations or people, and that it's more the philosophy behind it. And I just wanted to state my support for that philosophy. I think it is very important. And then kind of on that note, I was just thinking about an organization that I worked with. I handle a lot of religious worker visa petitions, and I worked with a missionary organization that also had a coffee shop. And we actually got into a whole, challenge with the case because we had to show that it was a religious organization, but they also had this coffee shop, but they were nonprofit, and it was really interesting. But I was just kind of curious, like, this is an organization that, like, they have a coffee shop on a university campus, and it seems like we don't want them to discriminate. And I thought what Commissioner Lucero said, where she just said, you know, this is what happens when you're doing business, is you are subject to the laws that exist in the state of Minnesota around non-discrimination. And so I was just curious if this might be like too specific for you, Commissioner, but I am curious, like, if a nonprofit that also is a missionary organization also runs just a random coffee shop, how would this law impact them? Thank you.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin, Representative Feist. So this is specifically about nonprofit service organizations whose primary function is providing occasional services to minors, such as youth sports organizations, scouting organizations. Your example is outside of the scope of what this exemption is about, period. Now, broadly speaking, there is a religious exemption that's built into law that allows, and that stays in place, where places are able to make decisions, including placing restrictions based on religion or sexual orientation, either, for those religious-based places.
Any follow-up, Representative Feist? It helped to have an actual example to actually get an answer. So thank you for sharing that. Any follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. It really does help because I feel like we were getting like way into the weeds and getting very, very like into abstractions. So that's helpful just to remind me like how narrow this really is. And it doesn't sound like it's going to impact very many organizations at all. So thank you so much.
All right, Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of quick questions. Commissioner Lucero, do we have an exemption in statute to allow nonprofit organizations to discriminate and on the basis of race?
Commissioner Lucero.
Chair Beckerfin, Representative Long, no, you do not. You cannot discriminate based on race.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow-up, Commissioner Lucero, do we have in statute an exemption for nonprofit organizations to discriminate on the basis of gender?
Commissioner Lucero.
Chair Beckerfin, Representative Long, no.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. So it seems like we have protected class protections that we have enshrined in our Human Rights Act for race, for gender, for gender orientation, but we treat one of those differently than the others. I was a Boy Scout for many years, and I stepped away even after I got my Eagle Scout award because I was really disgusted by the organization's discrimination at that time over sexual orientation. It seems like this was designed to allow discrimination to take place in organizations, and either we have a protected class or we don't. Either we have protections in place for gender, race, gender orientation, and sexual orientation, or we don't. So I think the line of questioning today really highlights the need for removing this, which is that essentially we've decided that one of those categories is not like the other, which is because it's a more disfavored status in our society. And I think that's one of the reasons why it deserves even more protection from our committee. So I just want to thank Representative Hollins for bringing this forward today.
Thank you, Representative Long. Finally, Representative Herr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my apologies for off camera. My internet is unstable today. So I'd love for you all to see my wonderful outfit today, but that might not happen. Chair Becker-Finn, I do just have a couple of really quick questions for Representative Hollins. Representative Hollins, I guess because I'm not a lawyer, I'm a little bit confused about the conversation today because I keep looking at your bill. And we're on House File 3270, is that correct?
Correct, Representative Herr.
So when I'm looking at this bill, I guess I'm confused about the conversation we're having today because the bill itself specifically relates to housing. Is that correct, Representative Hollins?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It does relate to housing, yes.
And so I guess the conversation that we're having—
Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. Well, I feel like we're all doing this today. So Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Hollins, thank you for that clarification because I feel like our conversation today has expanded well beyond the scope of what this bill is bringing before us. I think that I can see why someone, if they want to speak specifically to removing the dwelling for duplexes, but I guess there was very limited conversation to this. And so I just wanted to say, I wanted to make sure I was understanding that this is very narrow. It relates to housing, and it's specifically the sections that it references, 363.8.90 unfair discrimination practices related to real property. All of this actually has nothing to do with really the conversation we're having today. Am I understanding this correctly?
So Representative Herr, and this is good, as a relatively, you know, we have a lot of first and second term members in our legislature and always read the repealers.
Yeah.
Always. And I know when I printed it out, that came out on the second page, so it's easy to miss. But there are, the repealers do deal with exemptions based on employment, which are in section three, chapter 363A. So there is a little bit of that related to employment. Representative Hollins, I don't know if you want to say any more about that.
Yeah, that was exactly what I was going to say, is I think the repealer that's on the second page is probably being missed. I see that we're really focused on the nonprofit aspect of it, though, and not the housing section of it. And I appreciate Representative Herr bringing questions about the housing aspect of it, because I think it is important. So.
Yeah, and I'll also point out for members, so the thing that's before us that's in the repealer is not all nonprofits. It's the definition is around non-public service organizations, and then it's even more than just that. It's whose primary function is providing occasional services to minors, such as youth sports, scouting, boys and girls clubs, 4-H clubs, FFFA, music and arts clubs, things like that. So it is a very, so when we say that it doesn't impact that many people, that's what we're talking about, because this definition, it's not all nonprofits. It's only non-public service organizations as defined in subdivision 3 of chapter 363A.20. Any follow-up, Representative Herr?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. And that's actually what I was just trying to make sure I was understanding, because I'm one of the few people without a legal background. That's what I took the bill to mean as well. And so I really appreciate the clarification and to keep us sort of focused on what the bill is about. And with understanding that I am extremely supportive of Representative Hollins' bill, and I really appreciate her bringing this forward. And that is all I have for questions and understanding the bill. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Herr. And actually, that's really helpful, because if we as members have questions about what the bill does, and that means that the public likely would have questions as well. So I actually really appreciate when people are willing to ask questions. So thank you. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm the same as Representative Herr with the technical issues this morning, so I'll be off camera. Representative Hollins, thank you for bringing this bill, and I absolutely support it. And, you know, I've been listening to this conversation, and I enjoy robust conversations, but I'm just trying to make sure I'm clear and give my thoughts on what I take from this. You know, in terms of nonprofits, because that's where a lot of the conversation has been about this bill this morning, it seems like our Supreme Court has clearly settled that nonprofits have to follow non-discriminatory laws. And all we're doing here is removing, taking away something that is unconstitutional and has caused confusion within our law. And so, Representative Hollins, can you clarify that that's what we're doing here?
Representative Hollins.
Yes, that is correct. We're repealing a very narrow exception that was provided in the law.
Follow-up, Representative Frazier.
No, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hollins. Thank you for bringing this bill. Thank you, Commissioner Lucero, for answering all of the questions today. I thought you did very well in answering those questions, and I'm looking forward to supporting it. Thank you all.
Commissioner Lucero, always very prepared. Always appreciate that. Finally, we'll go to Representative Liebling, and then we'll close up. So, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So, you know, I think it's so important to read the repealers in this case. I'm so glad Representative Herr, you know, focused us on that, because when you look at what is in our law, it's frankly shocking to me that this stuff is in there. And I'm so glad Representative Hollins is bringing this forward, because these are remnants of something that I think is just so out of step and out of date and not the way people think anymore, thank goodness. And I would be absolutely embarrassed to vote against this bill. And I kind of hear that some members might be preparing to do that. I just wanted to make sure people know what's being repealed here. Some of it is just, it's kind of appalling, outdated stuff. So this construction of the law piece that is being repealed, you know, it's some of this says nothing in this chapter shall be construed to mean the state of Minnesota condones homosexuality or bisexuality or any equivalent lifestyle. For goodness sakes, this is not a lifestyle, people. I mean, we're so far beyond that. You know, I feel like I hope I don't have to say any more. I mean, if you read the language in here, this is just a no-brainer of let's pass this thing and get this stuff off the books. It is so unnecessary, and it's so mean, and it's so outdated. Thank you, Representative Hollins. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Closing comments, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for this conversation. You know, Minnesota added sexual orientation as a protected class in 1993, and it was a really big deal. We were way ahead of a lot of other states, which is fantastic, and one of the reasons why Minnesota is so revolutionary in a lot of the stuff that we do. However, during committee and floor vote processes, the bill authors made a lot of compromising amendments to get the bill passed into law, and these three provisions that we're talking about today were part of that process. The reality is we've come a long way since 1993, when I was 10 years old, right? I mean, a lot has changed since then. And the reality is either we have protections or we don't. I think Representative Long said it best. Individuals with, you know, should be protected based on their sexual orientation and gender identity. And it is time that our statutes caught up to the prevailing practices of our nonprofits, our housing providers, and our citizens of Minnesota. So with that, I would ask you to support this bill going forward. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you. And thank you, members, for the discussion this morning. Representative Hollins renews her motion that House File 3270 be referred to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chairbreaker Finn.
Aye.
Vice Chair Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
Nope.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen?
No.
Representative Novotny?
No.
Representative Farr?
No.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
And Representative Zhang?
Aye.
That is 10 ayes and 7 nays.
All right, the motion prevails and House File 3270 is on its way to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Hollins, for your bills this morning. So that moves us on to our next two bills today. So members, there have been some discussion of this issue on and off throughout session so far. regarding the courts deciding that they're going to start charging people to access online documents. There are a couple different bills before us. I'm going to start things off today with Representative Robbins' bill, House File 3041. So I will, Representative Robbins, would you like to move House File 3041 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I move that 3041 be laid over. Thank you.
All right. The bill is now before us. Representative Robbins, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I was contacted over interim by a couple different constituents who had heard that this was coming down the pike and that they were very concerned about the courts charging for online access to court documents. And so I started looking into it with our staff, and that is the intention of the courts, as we heard testified earlier in committee. And the funding is not going towards the courts or for paying for their IT system. It just goes into the general fund. And my constituents were very concerned about this as, first of all, costly for in one case, them and their clients who have to download documents for legal matters, for family law situations, and then a different constituent concerned about government transparency and how that would impact groups that are trying to understand different court procedures or different things going on in the courts, and that would be an enormous hit to their budget. So especially because these documents are available, they're printing them at their own cost. If they need to print them at all, sometimes they're just reviewing them. They would really appreciate if we addressed this and eliminated the online fee. So that's all the bill does. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Robbins. We do have a couple testifiers, and most of the testifiers were, because the bills are very similar and accomplish very similar things, folks were, and I'll also point members to look at the letters of support that were posted from several other organizations, including Minkoji and some journalism organizations. We do have a couple testifiers though. First, I will go to John Kavanaugh. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members, I am John Kavanaugh, Senior Counsel with Minnesota Public Radio. I am appearing before you today representing the Minnesota Broadcasters Association, the Minnesota Newspaper Association, and NPR. Our organizations have submitted a joint letter, which you just spoke to, supporting the elimination of the proposed $8 fee to view and download documents on the macro system. The letter should be in today's hearing packet. Minnesotans should not have to ration their research of court documents based upon their ability to access public information. Our readers, our viewers, our listeners, and you expect us to be thorough and accurate in our reporting. Attaching fees with no relation to the actual cost to provide this service, and which simply go to the general fund, serve only as an impediment to our work. Already financially struggling, local and regional news outlets would be hardest hit by this proposed fee. These organizations report stories important to their communities and are critical to American democracy. Minnesotans are best served by local and regional media with full access to public information. We first of all would like to thank Representative Robbins for being out front on this issue. When this issue arose in committee, you already had a bill ready to go, and we appreciate that. We also appreciate Chair Becker Finn's bill, as it also addresses, it not only eliminates the fee, but it also addresses the cost of in-person or over-the-counter documents as well. And we do appreciate that would likely draw down the cost of those documents. We also support the court's request that the documents, whether they are in person or online, be treated the same, and would love to see the fees struck for both types of access to those documents. Again, we thank you. We appreciate the courts and the new system. And we again support the bills as they are, but we again would support striking the over-counter fees as well. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Eric Wiefering. I'm not sure if I said that right. Please introduce yourself, tell us how to pronounce your name, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Very well done, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Eric Wafering. I'm an editor at the Star Tribune, where I oversee projects and investigations. Accessing criminal and civil court records is a core function of what we journalists do every day, sometimes multiple times a day. And imposing fees for viewing or downloading court documents would have an immediate chilling effect on the ability of reporters and even the public at large to follow the workings of Minnesota's judicial system. The proposed charges would be burdensome for any media organization, but especially so for smaller news outlets in greater Minnesota that are already facing significant challenges and in some cases are many miles away from a courthouse. The proposed charges also would have a dramatic impact on the investigative or watchdog function that the citizens of Minnesota expect from journalists, and that is indeed core to our mission. Last year, just as an example, the Star Tribune published an investigative project exposing abuses by companies that buy financial settlements from accident victims. The reporter in that case pulled more than 1,700 court cases from across the state. Each of those cases typically had another 5 to 10 additional documents that he had to pull for them. And then in the interest of fairness and accuracy, he also pulled criminal and other records associated with the individuals who sold their settlement payments. The total number of documents he viewed hit upwards of 20,000. You know, that was a project that was 2 years in the making. Would we have been able to do it, to invest that kind of time and money if these proposed charges were in place? As an editor, it's the kind of question I don't even want to have to answer. Court records are public records. They should be free to the public and the media, not only to people or institutions that can afford to pay for them. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, and happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for your testimony. I don't have any other testifiers specifically to House File 3041 on the list. We'll go to Vice Chair Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Robbins, for this bill, which I definitely support. I do have a question for the media outlets, and unless something has changed about this, you know, I don't know, but even for federal court documents, even parties have to pay to access those online. You get like one free view, and then after that, you have to pay for access. And I don't think there's any even exception for the public for federal for documents. And I'm just curious from the media outlets if that hampers their ability to report on cases that are moving through the federal system.
Mr. Kavanaugh or Mr. Wefring? I guess we'll go to Mr. Kavanaugh. You turned your camera on first.
Oops. Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Moeller. Indeed, there is a fee that is attached to. I'm more familiar with the PACER system at the federal level, which does allow or does charge, I believe, 10 cents per document. But I believe there's a $30 cap that only when you get to that $30 level that it kicks in. So there is an expense to it, have no doubt about it. But at the same time, it's at a much lower cost than the $8 fee itself.
Members, further discussion to the bill? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Robbins, for this bill. It's highly needed, and I think the courts, you know, because it's a statutory mandate that they charge for this stuff, I think it's the right thing to do to just repeal that piece of statute. I don't think the courts necessarily want to charge for online. It's just they have to listen to what the statute says. And so thank you for bringing this. It's going to continue to provide transparency for the public. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Scott. And I think I do want to, I'm grateful to the courts that they did put the effort into building this system, because it was very much needed. And I think we've talked about this in previous meetings where when I was a law clerk, you'd get sent to the basement of the government center to access the documents, and you'd have to sit at a little terminal. And then like But there was an option to look at all of them for free. And then if you wanted to take them home with you, you could print them off. Or once we had cell phones, you could take a picture of it. And that was the way that people were accessing the documents and not spending a lot of money. But, you know, closing down access to the buildings and the actual terminals in person is you know, what instigated some of this. And so I think making sure that public documents remain public, because they aren't actually public if nobody can actually see them, is incredibly important. And so I do thank Representative Robbins for working on this as well. Representative Robbins, any closing comments specifically to your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the testifiers. I also wanted to point out that it is supported by the State Bar Association as well. And I just appreciate everyone's support, and Chair Becker-Finn for your bill. I'm fully supportive of your addition. It's improving my bill, so I appreciate everyone's hard work. Thank you.
All right. With that, I will House File 3041 is laid over. And then technically, because we got to do it the right way here, it's a little unorthodox, but I'm just going to keep the gavel since this is all sort of the same sort of conversation here. I will move House File 3556. Be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And then just to speak to the difference in the bills, members, and if folks don't have them right in front of you. So the Representative Robbins bill states that no fee can be required to view or download an uncertified copy on an online platform. And then my bill also says that you can only charge what the actual cost is if you do go in person and print something out. Because right now it is set in statute, as Representative Scott referenced, it's set in statute that it's $8, even if it's a four-page document. It doesn't cost $8 to print off a four-page document, but that's what they've been required to do. And I also want to speak to, he's not on this committee, obviously, but Representative Munson and I had been working on this early on as well. I think a lot of us were hearing from constituents and both attorneys who wanted to access documents, as well as journalists and other folks who were very concerned when the court had shared that this was the plan going forward with the online documents. So appreciative to Representative Munson and everyone who's been working on this. And then in full disclosure, there is another version of the bill that's very similar that Senator Latz was working on. We were all working on the same sort of thing, and I will be introducing the House version of that bill. So I do intend to move that bill soon, probably next week. We won't have to have a full discussion. It's very similar to these two bills. And then very hopeful that we can get something worked out this year. It seems like there's across the board an acknowledgement that we have to address this soon, but there will be a cost because they're used to that money going to the general fund. So stay tuned for when we have that information. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question about your bill, if that's okay. Are you open it up for questions? Thank you, Madam Chair. So in your bill, you say the actual cost. Is that just the actual cost of the paper per se, or is it the actual cost that it takes for someone to locate the file, the manpower to do that?
The idea is that it would encompass all of that so that we're not sort of, one of the, and that this is a, I don't know if there'll be bills about it this year, but there is this ongoing issue too with where sometimes you'll have people sort of take advantage of the system and ask for sort of an incredible number of documents for the purposes of obstructing things or making things difficult. And so it isn't always as simple as, one person printing off one document that you were looking for. The idea with my bill is that, the 2 minutes of staff time, the wear and tear on the printer and the paper and the ink would be the actual cost. That's my intent with what the actual cost would be. But again, I'm open to workshopping language for whatever version is in the final bill. Follow up, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so maybe this question is for House Research on this topic, Mr. Hopkins, doesn't current law say that reasonable cost is at the standard right now? And so this would be changing it to actual. Just
Ben Johnson just turned on his camera, so we're going to go to Ben. Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, the current statute simply sets a rate for uncertified copies at $8. It's not tied to any particular reasonable cost or anything else. It's just a hard $8 fee.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess it is that way for the courts, but in other areas of statute, I think it's reasonable cost.
Mr. Johnson,
yeah.
If you're able to answer that, it's okay if you're not.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I'd have to look and see the consistency across different statutes. The provision that's in the bill for Representative Becker Finn indicates that it's a fee that's equal to the materials and labor used to produce the copy that's fixed by rule or order of the court. So it would allow the courts to determine kind of what that rate would be on essentially a per page basis. So if they were able to determine that it was 5 cents per page or 25 cents per page, they would be setting that by rule or order. And it's capped at a maximum of $8. So this wouldn't be able to go above the $8 fee that's current law. It would be that amount or less.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, thank you. And thank you, Mr. Johnson, for that explanation. And I guess the way the courts charge is different than other areas of the, because the courts aren't subject to the Minnesota Data Practices Act, but I don't want something like this language to set precedent for the Minnesota Data Practices Act, where you're going to be charging the public actual costs, because then that turns out to be very subjective in what that charge could be. And so I don't want, you know, members of the public being charged astronomical amounts to get data that they're entitled to. So that was my only caution with this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Representative Scott. And I think that's important for the legislative record to reflect that the intent here is to make sure that people do have access to things. We don't touch Chapter 13 in this bill, but appreciate you bringing that up. We do have one testifier who had signed up specifically to House File 3556, and I want to go to her next. Sarah Bush, if you can introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Becker Finn, Vice Chair Moeller, and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Bush. I am the Community Engagement and Outreach Coordinator at Missions, Inc. Programs. We provide shelter and supportive services to victims of domestic violence and individuals experiencing chemical dependency in Northwest Hennepin County. I'm here today in support of House File 3556. Our legal advocates support victims of domestic violence through civil and criminal court processes. As you can imagine, they frequently need to access district court documents online in order to support their clients in keeping themselves and their families as safe as possible. Our legal advocacy program serves approximately 600 victims with civil or criminal cases each year. So a fee associated with downloading or viewing court documents online would represent a huge financial burden for our program. Recently, one of our advocates downloaded 12 court documents for a single case. That's higher than average for a single case, but even accessing half that many documents for each of the clients we supported last year would cost our program over $28,000, which is about 9% of our entire program budget. More importantly, charging a fee to view or download online court documents would have a significant negative impact on the people we serve. To illustrate that impact, I want to share a few stories with you this morning. I've changed or disguised specifics to protect victim confidentiality, but these examples are based on the real experiences of our advocates and clients. A victim receives a call from one of our legal advocates the morning after they were assaulted by their intimate partner. Because the legal advocate was able to access the criminal complaint via Minnesota Court Records Online, or MCRO, the victim doesn't have to relive the traumatic experience by relaying the details of the incident to yet another person. Instead, their conversation can focus on the victim's immediate safety needs. Amid the many challenges of the COVID-19 pandemic, one positive that has emerged is that remote court hearings have allowed victims to much more easily attend court. With remote hearings, a victim who isn't able to travel to the courthouse, take time off work, or secure childcare can still participate in the court process. They don't have to be in the same room as their abuser in order to engage and understand the court process. MCRO allows advocates and victims to readily access remote hearing information. Finding new housing is one of the many ways in which victims seek safety from their abusers. Recently, an advocate used MCRO to help a victim access all of the eviction documentation she needed in order to begin working on expunging her record, as having a past eviction on her record was preventing her from accessing safe housing away from her abuser. In conclusion, our program could not afford to pay for every court document we access. Without free access, victims and advocates will lack key information when creating safety plans, court hearings will be less accessible to victims, and victims who are criminalized or facing eviction will encounter even greater barriers to accessing safety. We therefore urge you to support House File 3556. Thank you for your time and the opportunity to testify. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony and regrounding us in why this is so important for other folks in our community. Really appreciate you testifying today. I do have one question. We have Janet Marshall from the judicial branch here, and I have a question for Ms. Marshall. I believe she's on. So specifically, I've heard people refer to it as micro, macro, and MCRO. What do you as the courts refer to it as, Ms. Marshall, if you can introduce yourself and answer that question?
Chair Becker Finn and members of the committee, I'm Janet Marshall and I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. We pronounce it MCRO.
Minnesota was a fourth option. I didn't even know there was a fourth option. And now I'm really glad that I asked. I'm sure we'll all continue saying it in four or five different ways, but now that was my big question. So thank you, Ms. Marshall. That's all that I had for you. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you to your testifier, Ms. Bush. I had similar concerns expressed to me by some of my constituents. And I just wanted to point out that on my bill, and I'm sure it will be similar, there was a fiscal note, and it was $233,000 in FY23 and then $466,000 in 25. So just as we're thinking about the potential cost of this. And my personal recommendation to you and others as we look at the LATS bill is just to follow the federal 10 cent per fee after 30 pages or whatever to keep it aligned with federal if there is going to be a fee for in-person use of the court and their staff time. Just my own little thought. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you, Representative Robbins. And I'm sure, you know, we'll continue to discuss this. And when we do have an omnibus, you know, we can discuss it at that point as well. But appreciate the feedback and agree with you that I think, you know, if there are ways we can make this easier and more efficient for people to understand, that's a good thing. Members, any further discussion to House File 3556? All right. Seeing none, House File 3556 is laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Sometimes we get done early. Good job, everybody. I think we had some good discussions today, as always. Thank you to our testifiers and to our chief authors for doing a good job. You guys all knew your bills. I always appreciate it when people know their bills. So thank you all. With that, we are adjourned.